DCT Audio. The art of good listening.
You're listening to a podcast on the Audio Boom Network. This is A Mindful Life with me, Dave Thomas. Thank you for downloading this edition of the program. I do hope you enjoy it.
The Cat from Greece, welcome to A Mindful Life. Now, I know you wish to maintain your anonymity, and I suppose for very good reason. You are known on Twitter as The Cat from Greece. My burning question, one I've had for years, is where did that name come from?
Well, thank you for having me on, firstly. And it is from a children's book that I used to read to our boys when they were very little. It's a picture book. And it is called My Cat Likes to Hide in Boxes. And it's by Eve Sutton. And you should buy it because it's great. It's about cats who like to hide in very different places. And there's a rhyming couplet for each cat, like the cat from Norway got stuck in the doorway and the cat from Greece in the book joined the police.
Ah.
So when I was looking for a Twitter handle, that's where that comes from. The cat from Greece joined the police.
That's excellent. Well, thank you very much for coming to the interview. It's been a pleasure. If nothing else today, I've learned something.
Yes, I'm not a cat or from Greece, despite the fact that lots of people think I might be. And there are a lot of bot accounts who text me or tweet me in Greek because they just read the name.
Because you do have quite a sizable Twitter presence, don't you?
Reasonable. Not as big as my wife's, which is important.
Right. Well, I can't think of anyone I know that is both a criminal barrister and a serving police officer. To describe that as unique would be a generalisation, really. So in a sense, to use a well-known phrase, you truly are burning the candle at both ends. So can you describe your journey of being able to be in two places at once, I suppose? Metaphorically, anyway.
Yeah, only metaphorically. I think the best I've ever managed, I was in the Old Bailey for a mention in the morning. I went to late turn straight from court. But that's the closest I've got to sort of doing it at the same time. I grew up wanting to be a police officer. Since I can remember wanting to be anything, I wanted to be a police officer. Went through school and university with that in mind, watched a lot of The Bill, and got to third year of university, applied to the Met, passed its recruitment process. It's long enough ago that involved running around cones and pushing and pulling things, and was just waiting for finals, firstly, and then a start date at Hendon in the autumn. And they sent me a letter saying, your application is being discontinued. We don't have to tell you why, and we're not going to.
Fascinating.
And that was...
Did you ever find out why?
I did not. No, I panicked and became a barrister.
Could you put a Freedom of Information Act in?
Possibly. It would be depressing, probably. I don't know what it was. If I'd thought about it a bit more and been a bit more mature about it, there are 42 other police forces. And at that time in my life, I could have gone and lived anywhere. But it had been...
That is
my ambition for so long that when it was sort of very suddenly taken away, I didn't really know what to do, genuinely.
That must have been quite a blow, seriously.
Oh, so one of the worst days of my life. Can still remember seeing the letter.
You still have the letter?
I still have the letter.
We'll leave that there.
It's around somewhere. I had done some work experience with a criminal barrister friend of the family, because it's tricky to do work experience with the police and it was sort of relevant to what I wanted to do, and had thought at the time, this is quite cool. And so when one thing sort of, to my mind, stopped, I thought, well, what else can I do that is, you know, a job I have seen done and thought was interesting and is in the same field? So hence, yes, ending up at the bar.
I've got my police head's on now and it's switched on and I'm wearing, just thinking, is there any people in your family that know people in the Met high up and thinking, well, we don't want you to throw your life away being a police officer. We need you to do something else.
If my parents had that sort of influence, they would have used it because they were not pleased with the ambition. But I mean, God knows what it was.
How strange.
And so that was when I was just leaving university. And so 10 years or so later, I had not ceased whinging about not being a policeman to Jane, who's my wife and was my girlfriend when I was applying to the Met in the first place, got rejected. And so eventually, having got tired of the whinging, she said, well, why don't you look into joining as a special? And I applied to the Met as a special and they said, we told you the first time. They didn't, but they rejected me.
We still have your application.
No, they didn't make reference to the first one. It was a much more kind of computer says no thing about my job, the being a barrister. And so I thought, well, you know, where else can I go? And picked another force that was easy enough for me to get to.
Yes.
And they fortunately didn't have the same issue as the Met.
Right. Fascinating. So how long have you been a special now?
I've been a special for 14 years.
Okay. And I think for people that don't know, who are listening to the podcast, the difference between a regular police officer and a special police officer is you volunteer your own hours and you don't get paid. And I've always been in awe of people that do that. And certainly when I was on traffic, I backed their hand off. And there were some bloody good officers in there that I'm thinking, you would make a really good regular police officer. But I think in some ways that's why they were good special police officers, because they didn't want to be a regular.
Yes.
And they had that sense of perspective, I suppose.
Yeah, you do see it from outside the organisation. But yes, that's the difference. You don't get paid. You can effectively choose when you work, as long as you do the minimum commitment. And formally speaking, I think now the only thing you absolutely cannot do is carry a gun, because forces, it's now permitted, depending on what force you're in, to carry taser. And they can train up, again, the force and resources permitting, you can train up to TPAC advanced driver.
Well, that's excellent. So being a special police officer, that must present some operational problems, both as an officer and as a barrister. Can you think of any occasions, either on the street or in the courtroom, where a conflict of interest has perhaps, and was, you know, the defendant shouting, "Go said, I know you."
No, not yet. But by a fluke of who instructs me in the CPS, because I'm a prosecutor, basically. Although I'm an independent, I don't work for the CPS. I'm self-employed, but all my work is prosecution work, which comes through the CPS. And like any other job where you're self-employed, you're working on referrals. And I don't happen to know anybody in the CPS area where I police. And so I never get instructions from there. So fortunately, that precise thing has never come up, because just by that chance, I once been at court prosecuting on behalf of the General Osteopathic Council.
Must have been a back-breaking work.
Oh, thank you very much. Very good. It's an offence to call yourself an osteopath if you're not one. It's a summary offence. Understandably enough, the cops aren't that keen on dealing with it, so
no. They
do it themselves. So you get sent to the magistrate's court all over the place to go and deal with people who've done that. And I was at a magistrate's court, and it's always a non-police or CPS day. So all the private prosecutors, the rail companies and everybody else who isn't the CPS gets a day in the magistrate's court to come and do their thing. Saliently for this story, there's no cops there, therefore. And a guy who was always on briefing where I work came in, and he's always wanted. He's always wanted. And I thought, I'd better check. And if he is, I'd better do something about it. And there I was in not my finery, because it was the magistrate's court, but suit, tie, and a pen.
So was it a case of metaphorically pulling your gown apart and showing the stab vest?
Fortunately, because I rang it in, and thank God for that 5 minutes of his adult life, he wasn't wanted.
Yeah.
So I didn't have to do anything about it. But that's the closest I've come to actually having to do something there and then when I was at the other job. And two trials ago, one of the prospective jurors was somebody who used to be my skipper.
Ah.
So we had to negotiate that when she came into court with the jury panel. Went back to do a different trial.
Yes. Interesting.
In my second ever trial, this isn't about being a policeman, but just horrible things that happened to you. My second ever Crown Court trial. So I was quite nervous. And at that stage in your career, you really, really don't want anything to happen that's about you. My A-level history teacher turned up on the jury panel. So I had to stand up and say, I know him, and draw attention to myself. That was not good.
They didn't say, and I can't believe he's a barrister now.
No, he waved. He waved very nicely and asked me how I was doing across the courtroom in front of everybody. I was like, please, I can't talk.
Has there ever been a situation where the judge, either like a magistrate or a stipendiary, or perhaps even in Crown Court, where the judge has recognised you from a case perhaps where you were a police witness?
No, because again, I don't work where I work,
no
as
crossover.
It were. So yeah. There isn't that kind of...
And you would hope the CPS might pick up on that.
Also, I've never managed to be a police witness. I've got into the waiting room of the magistrate's courts twice and have not yet penetrated the witness box.
Lucky you. You're in a unique position, and I'm sure police officers and court advocates' ears will be burning with this podcast. What issues of impediment, and I'm talking now from all sides, really, from the judiciary and just the police organisation itself. So what impediments face police officers when they go to court?
I think the job does officers no favours in the way that it, A, doesn't prepare them at all for going to court, and you can be quite long service now, quite long service in the 2023 police service, so like 2 years, without ever going to court to give evidence, just because of how things are. And even to come across detectives or trainee detectives for cases of mine who are in charge, you know, officers in the case, and they've never given evidence before the trial that I'm doing with them, even though they're 3 or 4 years in. There doesn't seem to, obviously all forces are different, but I haven't yet come across one that does formal training, like proper training, just to explain very simply to officers what it's like going to court, what they need, and if you're going to be in the officer in the case, what you need to have with you and what you need to know. But to the extent that I've done training for the force I work for my team and sister teams about that, because nobody else tells them. And the upshot of that I see on the other side is officers turn out with absolutely no idea really what they're supposed to do and know and bring with them if they're the officer in the case. And there's also in the informal culture of the job, court is always held up as somewhere where something terrible will happen. You will have some sort of nightmare. Avoid going if at all possible is the informal and to an extent the formal kind of job attitude to going to court, which is ridiculous because you're going to have to. And all that happens with that attitude is that people avoid making statements because they don't want to go to court, or they avoid doing things that might put them in the evidential chain because they don't want to go to court. Whereas in fact, I've been a barrister for 23 years. And in that time, I've seen an officer have a genuinely difficult time 3 times. That's it. Every other officer in every other case I've ever done, they've come into the witness box, they've answered some questions and they have gone away again, you know, without the least difficulty. Whereas it's presented to cops, especially those who haven't done it before, as somewhere that is inevitably going to be the end of the world. And that's completely counterproductive. But we don't start self-defense officer safety training by saying there's more or less no chance that you'll get through this without having your head kicked in. And we don't start first aid training by saying to officers, you can try this stuff, but they're going to die. Yeah. But we allow officers to assume that if you go to court, some appalling thing will happen to you. It's just not true.
It's a very interesting point you raised. I remember when in 97 that I joined, and we did have court training as probationers long before specialisation. And we did have a courtroom exercise for the day, which I found was useful. And then when I did I was on CID and I was doing my suspect interviewing course, we had another day where we were purposely cross-examined.
Mm.
But the whole point of that was try not to get flustered. And I've, to be honest with you, my worst experience of court was in magistrates, because you'd have the solicitors there.
Everyone's worst experience of court is the magistrates.
Grilling you. And there was one particular case, it was a traffic case, it was a fail to stop. I was getting an absolute grilling. And the prosecutor kept standing up to the magistrate saying, look, it's not the way this officer's been questioned is unfair. Nothing happened. And for an hour I had it, and I came out and I was shaking. I don't know if I was shaking because I was seething mad or just in Crown Court, that just doesn't happen because the judge rules the roost. And to be fair, I think most of the questions that I've answered were yes or no. It was always, did you do this? Were you here? Yes, no. Whereas magistrates is, can you tell me what happened?
Yes. Magistrates is just chaos. Nobody has a good time.
It's exactly what it is.
Magistrates is the A&E of the criminal justice system.
That's a very good way of putting it.
People turn up very often, exactly the same people who are in A&E. People are drunk. People are bleeding sometimes still in the court. And there's far too many people. It all gets very, very rushed. And nobody basically has time to do a good job. Whereas going to Crown Court is a bit more like having an outpatient's appointment. You might be a couple of hours late getting in, but it's much more organised and much slower and much more controlled.
Yes.
And actually, that's a lot easier.
Yes. And I suppose why police officers get a little bit anxious about it is the fact that you have a jury, which you don't get in magistrates' courts.
No.
And that's a big difference.
There's no particular reason why that should make cops feel, I mean, they're just humans, and so are most policemen. So just answer the questions.
Yes.
If the answer is we couldn't afford to do that, as a line of, you know, we couldn't afford to send off all the drugs wraps for forensics. I tried to, but I was told we haven't got the budget for it. I didn't have time to do this inquiry. Just say so.
Yeah.
It's like the people understand. Basically, if you're going to have a bad time at Crown Court, the reason for that will be months and months in the past.
Yes.
Because exactly. It was something you've not done.
Yes.
It won't be because some barristers tripped you up with some silvery wordplay in the witness box. That's not how it works. If you have the times I was referring to when these three officers had a genuinely bad day, was because they hadn't done a very good job. They're all officers in the case, not witnesses of two incidents, and they had not done a very good job with the investigation. And that, you know, by the time you're in standing in the witness box, that's not fixable. And the only thing you can do is say, I should have done that. I'm sorry.
Yes. So, okay then. So you train police officers in your own force about court etiquette and how to conduct yourself. Obviously, a lot of problems that do happen in court, as you've rightly said, are things that have happened long ago in the investigation. Yeah, possibly 2 years before the court case. There's nothing you can do about that. But just about on the day now in court, what sort of things should police officers be doing?
If you're turning up because you're a witness as opposed to just the officer in the case, turn up would be charming. Most of them do, but you always get, certainly every month, you get an officer sending an email to witness care saying, why can't they just read my statement? I haven't got anything else to add. It's like, that's not the point. Yeah. The reason you've been fully bound is probably, anyway, because they disagree with something you've said. So they've got to cross-examine you about it. So nobody can't just read your statement out. That's not how this works. So turn up and read your statement or notes or whatever you've got. Actually read them. And if you have said in your statement that you've acted in a particular, done something or not done something under a particular legal power, then make sure you actually know that what that was. It just being a bit of cut and paste and you put in all your statements because you might get asked. But broadly, otherwise, just listen to the question, answer the question. If the answer's I don't know, that's fine. Or if the answer's ask DCX, who's the officer in the case, that's also fine. And you'll be all right. Don't argue with counsel.
No, and that actually happened in one of my cases. And it was the defence who was actually turned around and said, are you jousting with me, Mr.? So and so, and it got quite heated.
Even if you win, that's not a good look for your side, because you're the cops, we're the prosecution. We are not here to score cheap points. We're not here to have a debating competition. We're here to put the evidence before the jury and so they can decide. So even if you're winning against counsel, that's not really what you're there to do. If you're the officer in the case, if it's your job, it's your job. Like, make sure you know which witnesses are coming when. Mm. I know there's a witness care department, but they're not very good very often.
I think they're just maxed out, aren't they?
Well, absolutely. But for whatever reason, if I'm turning up as counsel, I want to be talking to the officer in the case and I want them to know which witnesses are coming when and who we're still in touch with and who we can't now get hold of or whatever. So make sure you've done that, not left it all to somebody else. Make sure you've read the crime report recently and have got access to it so you can answer questions about it. If you're going to use your laptop for that purpose, naming no particular trainee detective constable's names, make sure it isn't on 5% battery. So the minute you switch it on to answer the judge's question in that instance, it switches off and we have to adjourn the trial for 45 minutes while your laptop charges up. It's fine to use a laptop in the witness box to answer stuff because in if you're using a case management system like Niche, everything is going to be on there. There's no point in having a big pile of pieces of paper. But yeah, as I say, on the day, there's no, apart from sort of turning up in good time and being willing, as the officer in the case, how good an experience this trial is going to be is decided way before by the quality of the investigation.
Exactly. And I think a lot of officers get hung up on interviews as well. I mean, it is important that the interview is done properly in line with pace and the right questions are asked. But I'm amazed at how many trials I've been to where the interview played a very little part in finding guilt.
Yeah.
Because it was the evidence that that convicted
We don't,
them.
Thank goodness, in this country, we don't have a very heavily confession-based system. Mm. Whereas if you watch programs about how in America, for example, how they investigate murder, because murder is like a volume crime for them.
Yes.
So they just don't have the resources to investigate every murder like we would investigate every murder. So they're very heavily reliant, certainly in a lot of the jurisdictions I've seen programs about, on people confessing because they don't have the resources to do all the other work that in this country means we don't rely on people. Nice if they do, obviously it's charming if they do, but we don't need them to do it. Whereas in those jurisdictions, they really do need a statement from that person, because otherwise they're not going to have the time to prove the case. There is an art to interviewing somebody who's denying the offence in a way that screws them up. And I've seen, I did a murder a few years ago where there was four DVDs of really beautiful interviewing, which ultimately forced the guy into a position where he had to plead guilty to murder. Obviously, interviewing is, if they're talking to you and you're good enough and they're stupid enough, you can get a good result that way. But broadly speaking, most of the time they're not talking to you anyway. So it's just a matter of making sure you've asked all the questions so that the inference is available.
Absolutely.
At trial.
Yes.
Or it's a matter of getting them to tell you as much checkable detail as possible that you can then, and you actually then have to do this, if it's going to work, do the inquiries to disprove.
Okay, so perhaps on the other side of the fence then, and we've kind of covered it a little bit, haven't we, with the conversation we've been having. So as a barrister, what makes a case more difficult to prosecute when perhaps police evidence isn't up to muster?
What makes it hard is if you haven't followed obvious lines of inquiry without a good reason. If the borough forensic manager, to borrow a Met term, won't pay for your drug wrappings to go and be fingerprinted, fine, there's nothing you can do about that. Yeah. Make sure you document it so nobody thinks it's your fault. But there we go, c'est la guerre. But unfortunately, several times now this is just reflects where I work rather than anything else, but with Met cases, which are investigated on BCU, so at borough level, divisional level for a county force, you are getting officers coming into CID who are not detectives, except that that's their job title. And they don't, it's particularly if somebody is in custody, so they've got a prisoner in the bin already, they're, as long as they can get that person charged, they're not really doing anything else. One of those cases is one of the ones where the officer had an absolutely terrible time in court because, and I hasten to add on my own behalf, I didn't get this case until it was not fixable anymore. He hadn't done very, very basic things, which were then, you couldn't then repeat or you could do for the first time rather, because it was too late. What makes a case difficult to prosecute is my not having enough evidence to prove it, which sounds trite, but that will be often because the officer investigating it hasn't just sat down, thought to themselves, right, how many open doors are there through which this guy or woman, usually guy, can escape? How many open doors are there that I can shut? Some doors you can't shut because it's not within, you can't investigate your way to that point, but there will be a lot of them that you can, and you need to sit down and think to yourself, I know this person's been charged, and therefore the job has ceased to care about this because that's the cutoff point for police statistics. But if we're going to prove this at court, I need to make sure that there are as few doors remaining open when we get before a jury as I can. And if you don't do that, that's when it gets hard to do my job, because all I'm doing basically is standing up and talking and presenting the evidence. And I can only present the evidence that there is. So I can't fix it by advocacy. So that's when it makes it difficult.
And should that happen? Because certainly, unless the systems change, CPS actions, all these inquiries have timelines and deadlines and really should be done, especially if it's a Crown Court, you've got your four stages of trial preparation.
No, it shouldn't happen. But a lot of the time, and I see this with my own team, we operate a system where they carry investigations despite being response cops. And so I see the memos that come through to the CPS from them. And also I've seen the memos that CPS write in my cases as a barrister. And they are so very little to do with the things that we actually need to do to prove this offence. It so often is the MG0BZ10 hasn't been uploaded to the... I don't care, as a prosecuting barrister, do we have the evidence served in admissible format that we need to prove this case? Not have the file quality standards been adhered to. But what's coming back from the CPS to the officers very often is incredibly trivial, irrelevant queries about process rather than what end result are we all trying to achieve here, which is convicting this person, and what do we need to do to achieve that? Everybody basically wants to get the trial, once it's started, they want to get the trial finished. Nobody really wants to be the person standing up and saying, actually, I think this trial needs to stop. So it will happen in 18 months' time. So on all sides, if a workaround, generally speaking, if a workaround for an issue can be found, everybody's on board with that.
Now, before I get to my final question, it would be remiss of me not to have a discussion with you about trial by jury. And I think this is where you and I might disagree. I am coming to the conclusion that for certain offences, at least, they are becoming unfit for purpose. And the reason I say that is I've actually been sat on a jury. I've got to be very careful about what I say because obviously I was on that jury. All I will say is what I saw, and it was my opinion, that the jury, it wasn't who they believed, it was who they liked. And I thought in this particular case, it was strong, damning evidence that would lead to a conviction when in fact the person was acquitted. It made me think that if this case, it was a sexual offence case, I should have qualified that. And I just thought that maybe if this was heard perhaps before three judges, and I'm just using that as an example because I don't really think there is legislation at the moment, then perhaps we might have had a different verdict.
I should preface, but I've actually been on the jury as well when I was 18. Like, it practically arrived with my 18th birthday card, the jury summons. But I'll come back to that because it's not particularly relevant to this discussion. I should qualify or preface but the answer to that question, but I don't do RASO, so rape and serious sexual offences cases. I'm not on the list to prosecute those cases. I've never done one in my career, so I absolutely cannot comment with any authority whatsoever in how juries are directed or approach or deal with those cases because I've no experience of that. Having said that, I have obviously spent 23 years, or 21 years, doing jury trials. And my very clear view is that a bit like democracy being the best, the worst system of doing things apart from all the other ones, it has its flaws, no doubt. But I cannot think and have never heard of a better way of doing it. And I have only in that quite long period of time now, only on two occasions have I ever had a verdict from a jury that I couldn't understand. I have disagreed with verdicts. That haven't gone my way. I have thought that they might have convicted somebody who they've acquitted, but that is not the same as being completely unable to understand why they've reached a verdict. That's only happened twice, which is not bad as a number over that period of time. How many trials I've done, so quite a lot. Far more frequently than I have even disagreed with a verdict, have I been impressed with however they've done it, and you don't know how they've done it. And if anybody ever did explore in detail and in public how they did it, probably the jury system would end the next day. But however they've done it, they have arrived at what look to everybody involved in the case, so all the lawyers, not so much the defendant sometimes, but the lawyers, they have arrived at careful, considered, fair, much fairer sometimes than I was asking for, in as much as they've convicted people of some things where the evidence was particularly strong and not on other things where we rely on inferences. So I would have convicted that person on the inference because I do, and probably so would a judge. But they haven't because they weren't willing to take that extra step, which is fair enough. But they have produced careful, considered, very fair verdicts in numberless cases that I've done. And like I say, we don't know how they've done it because nobody's allowed to ask for very good reason because, as I say, I think they're probably the end of the jury system if anybody ever did. So I can only go by the quality of the product, and the quality of the product in terms of the verdicts that they've delivered has pretty much always, in my cases, been very high.
I suppose the other thing, my argument is flawed, I suppose, by a lack of evidence. Which is interesting. We're a former police officer and barrister, and we're talking about lack of evidence. But it goes back to the old saying of courage of your convictions. And again, for people that have not been to court, the summing up, which is basically when prosecution and defence address the jury before the judge has his say, the defence always say, the final thing they always say to the jury is, you must be sure beyond a reasonable doubt.
It's very often the first thing they say to the jury as well, and in the middle.
And in the middle, and at the end perhaps, yes. But they really try to impress on the jury that they must be sure beyond a reasonable doubt. And I sometimes wonder if juries understand what they're being asked of, because I do get the impression that they're thinking, well, unless I think he's 100% or her 100% guilty, then I've got to find not guilty. And it's this courage of your convictions. And I'm just wondering whether, because juries represent society, and society, I think, has changed over the years for all sorts of reasons. And it's too big a topic for us to talk about now. The way society operates now and the influences on it, and external influences and upbringings. And I honestly think now that people are scared to say if somebody's guilty or make that decision, especially if it's a serious offence that may carry a life tariff. And that's why part of me thinks, are jury trials fit for purpose?
In my own, there's a lot of convicted murderers who would tearfully disagree with you about that. People, certainly in my experience, juries have no problem convicting people where they would, obviously they aren't told necessarily, in a murder they know. They aren't told, but they must infer from the charge that it's not good news for the defendant. I don't think people, as long as they are sure, I don't think people have a problem acting on that conviction.
I don't think it's explained enough in court of how sure is sure.
As the more you explain it, and this, you quite often get questions from juries, what does sure mean? And the trouble, the reason there's no sort of greater elucidation of it is because when you try, as soon as you try to explain in any greater detail or put a test to it, it gets worse and more confusing, which is why it's very deliberately, it's not beyond reasonable doubt, because what does that mean? It's sure. And there are standard directions you can give if you get that inevitable, but very frequent question about what sure means, which really don't change the basic direction, which is that you know what sure means because you live your lives using that word and you're familiar with that concept. But yeah, the reason it's not elucidated more is when you try, what generally happens is when you're discussing a question like that in the absence of the jury, counsel and the judge come up with what they think are helpful, sort of, as I say, elucidations of what sure means, each one of which is more confusing than the last, until they eventually just say they need to be sure, just repeat it to them.
Well, it's the old saying, isn't it? Better a guilty man walks three than an innocent man gets convicted.
Yes, that is the expression. I mean, obviously, as a matter of fact, but not law, which is the important distinction, most people presented before a Crown Court jury are guilty. That's why they're there, in the sense of they are, as a matter of fact, the person who did it. The difference being they may not be, as a matter of law, demonstrably, on the evidence that's available, the person who did it.
So finally, as the great policing phrase often repeated, we are where we are, or it is what it is. And as our criminal justice system buckles, and I think it is buckling, to be honest with you, what, in your opinion, are some important life-saving actions the government and the police and the judiciary could make in the short term to jumpstart this system again, which was once considered to be the finest system in the world?
And it's still, from the court point of view, coming on to the policing point of view, which I think is slightly worse, it still doesn't suck. As a way of, particularly in the Crown Court, jury trials as administered in this country, for all that they are under-resourced and the system is creaking and the buildings are literally about to fall down in the case of Harrow Crown Court, it is still a system in which I have faith, because it would be very difficult to work in it as a prosecutor if you didn't think you were producing fair results. Boringly, it all comes down to money, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not the system, it's the infrastructure that supports that system. And when I say, you know, is it fit for purpose, when I think of these, and I've had it, you know, victims of rape that have been 3-4 times to Crown Court, and there's a floating trial, they get sent away, and we're now 4 years into a judicial process, and they've still not had a trial.
Oh, it's awful. It's awful, and particularly for those sorts of offences, but they're...
And it's awful for the person accused of the offence as well. I always think of it on both levels, because if you've been accused of that,
yes,
you also want to get it sorted.
And you might be subject, depending on what it is, you might be subject to some bail conditions that are actually pretty impactful on your life for a very long time. It all comes down to money. Capacity, to put it another way, which is another way of saying we haven't got enough money, there isn't enough capacity, because court room capacity, court staff, because maybe people don't forget, but I think people sometimes forget that it's not just judges, of which there is a shortage. There is a shortage of judges or courtrooms. In fact, we don't have a shortage of courtrooms, but to run a courtroom so that it can actually operate, you need not only a judge, but you need court staff, the court clerk, ushers, to make that court actually functional. And don't get treated very well, don't get paid very much. And as a consequence, there are far fewer of them than there used to be. It is all a question of money. And we see it, you know, in my response team, we have so many fewer people than we used to. Even when I started in 2009, and we would be parading 15 cops, probably. Now we'd be parading for the same shift, maybe 5 people. One of them would be the skipper, so maybe he or she can't go out. because I've got stuff to do. So single crew cars, except on nights. So that goes down to two cars for a double crew night turn. They are all kids, apart from me, which has always been a true to an extent of response because that's where people come into. But when I started, there were kids and there were very experienced PCs, PSs on the shift who they would turn up to a job and you would see them and you'd know everything was going to be all right because they knew what they were doing.
Yes.
Now, I'm not dissing the people I work with. They are good cops, but there's nobody like that on the shift now, unless you counted me. And I'm not exactly there every day. So they're having to work it out for themselves to an extent their predecessors did not. And they're having, which when I started, the system didn't operate. They're investigating in addition to going to 999 calls, and proactivity is just dead because there's no time to do it.
No, there isn't. There's no proactive work. There's no community policing.
So it's you're between the queue, as in the queue of calls and the control room, and your investigations. And the investigations do not win because if somebody calls 999, it's an immediate grade. Somebody has to go. So it's a really harsh environment. And the only thing that can make it better, there is no process that you could change to make it better. You just need more people so that there were enough people to go to the 999 calls and investigate the offences properly and go back out and do some proactive work.
Well, 5 to 10 years ago, it was a matter of numbers. But now it's not even that now. It's a matter of experience, as you rightly say.
And I mean, and numbers would be nice too.
Numbers would be nice, but you can't get 20-year in cop with that experience by recruiting an extra 5,000 cops next year.
Can.
Because it's going to take 20 years for them to get that similar experience. So we've got this big hole, and it certainly happened in the force I was in. You could see it. They had, you know, the big recruitment drives. And then 30 years after that recruitment drive, you could see all the experience leave the job and leave a hole. And I'm sure that's relevant to other forces across the country. And it takes time to get that experience back. I think the way we police has changed as well now. I mean, going back to something you said earlier, I had the luxury when I joined that I had a tutor and we had time to investigate jobs. And I was always taught, don't look for the arrest, look for the conviction. Don't even look for a charge.
Yeah.
Look for a conviction. Get your evidence for a conviction. And it's never left me. But people don't have the time to do that now.
And they also don't know. They don't necessarily know what that means. Somebody has to tell you. Otherwise, it's just in words. Somebody has to tell you what they mean by that and what you will have to do to achieve that.
Yeah.
And if your team is being supervised by a PS who's 3 years in, your most senior colleague is 18 months in, there's nobody there, and none of them ever worked in CID as full-time investigators. There's nobody to tell you how you're going to do that and what you need to do that, even if you had the time to do it, which you probably don't.
And again, it's cuts to specialist units. Certainly, I remember a time where every shift, when I was in uniform, every shift had an armed response unit attached to it, had a dog, had a CID, even on nights. Each shift had its own, you know, the same person all the time. So when you did have a job that needed a little bit of thought, it was always on tap there. And it was always, and it was a bit of the old synergy theory, isn't it? The 2 and 2 equals 5. That collectively as a shift, you had a good output of investigation because it was all those resources that were available to you.
Yes.
And now they're gone.
Yeah, most forces, mine included, has some sort of tie-in with a different force for dogs, trafficking firearms.
Yeah.
So nothing's easy. And we've now got a generation of cops. I sound like an old fart. a part-time old fart as well. But there's a generation of police officers now who've never done proactive work in uniform.
Which is a shame.
You've never gone hunting.
That's the best bit.
Yeah, exactly. A, it was the most enjoyable bit of response work. We used to be going out and finding people. And B, that's quite a loss for the public.
Yes.
That you've got cops who are not out looking for baddies, learning the sort of very subtle, more subtle ways that you can try and find people up to no good, because they've never done it. Nobody they work with has ever done it. There isn't time to do it. That's why no one's ever done it. So even if we somehow went back to a situation where there was time to do it, we've got huge de-skilling in that. Apart from those who, then they do exist, who are natural born hunters, who will always be that way. And that's just, as I say, that's in your genes, I think. But there's not enough of them to make up for the fact that you got, as I say, a generation of cops who've never been taken out on a night shift by an older officer and said, well, you're going to tell me which cars we're stopping and why, to hone that instinct as to which ones are the, you know, how you're going to find people.
So I suppose as somebody that, as I say, works on both sides of the fence, have the public got any cause for optimism in the future, do you think, with government plans?
The cause for optimism in relation to the government is that they probably won't be the government indefinitely. I think that's as much you can say about them. Yeah, the cause for optimism is that, and I work with them, that they keep showing up.
They're good people kids, at the end of the day, aren't they?
And I keep calling them that. Probably wouldn't appreciate it. Sorry, everyone. But that they've joined, they want to do a good job. They do a good job. You know, they're brave and they will put themselves in harm's way for you. And those people still exist and they're still coming through. That's the cause for optimism. They for all the stuff that's going on in policing at the moment, it's not easy to be a cop now.
No.
It's not easy to, you know, it's not even...
I'm not sure I could. We always used to ask, you know, if I had to join now, A, would I get in, and B, could I do it? And I'm not sure I could say yes to either of those questions.
Yeah, because a lot of the, obviously, it's still something I think to be very proud of, but that's been battered senseless over the last couple of years with the various things that have happened. You know, for people to keep showing up through all that, through being despised by a lot of the public, actively hated by a good minority of the public, to do a job which is very often unpleasant, dangerous, and they're still turning up to do it. That's the cause for optimism. Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of old heads on young shoulders at the moment, I think, in police forces or up and down the country.
Yeah, the learning curve, especially if you're any good, the learning curve is very, very steep.
Yes.
And we haven't got started on it, and we haven't got time, and I would get cross the whole degree thing, which is...
Oh, well, yeah, don't go there.
...placed a massive, unnecessary burden on these poor men and women who are trying to learn how to be something that's quite difficult to learn how to be if you're not trying to do something else at the same time, to be a cop. It's hard, but people still want to do it. And people are still, for almost no money and very little respect, prepared to do it.
And that, I suppose, you're right, that is the cause for optimism. Well, the cat from Greece who nearly got in the police.
Yes, sort of eventually, I think is what I can say about that.
Genuinely, thank you so much for your
Not
time
at all.
Today.
Thank you
I've enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you very much.